Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
But you also had people that were very fine people.
Very fine people.
On both sides.
And the aliens would mind meld and give them the technology. They're bad aliens. So are you surprised the Nazis were influenced by demons?
No, if demons are real, I would definitely think they'd be on the side of the Nazis.
Yeah.
McDonald's is connected to the Clintons. They chop up the bodies and put them into the sausage and hamburgers. People are being cannibalized. Look it up.
And I'm watching CNN talk about this as violent white nationalist protests. We have done everything in our power to keep this peaceful, you know?
It's Pepe's become kind of a symbol.
Welcome to Yeah Nah Passeran, a show about fascism and its gravediggers. I'm Cam Smith.
I'm Andy Fleming.
And this week we are joined by Annie Kelly, roving reporter for QAnon Anonymous and researcher of conspiracy theories. Thanks for joining us, Annie.
Thanks so much for having me on. It's been a really long time. I can't remember when I last spoke to you guys.
I think it might have been like 2020.
Wow.
Has anything changed in the world of conspiracy theories since then?
No, it's pretty quiet, to be honest with you.
I guess just to begin with, QAnon is something we would have talked about at length last time you were on.
Mm-hmm.
Now that the fox is in the hen house, so to speak, how's QAnon going now that they run the government?
Yeah, I mean, it's been such an interesting blessing and a curse. I mean, to me, there's something that's really funny about up until the point where it actually happened, I suppose. It's almost like a sitcom premise to me, a conspiracy theorist becoming director general of the FBI. Do you know? Like, I mean, it sort of feels like, yeah, it feels like a kind of comedy movie premise. But I think it has created, I mean, in the last week, I've been watching these kind of fascinating fissures within the MAGA movement itself. It really feels like it's all come to a head with the, well, I guess I'll start from the beginning for people who haven't been watching this as closely on social media as I have. So the Trump administration appointed several influencers who were, if not outright QAnon, certainly flirting with that movement. People like Dan Bongino, Pam Bondi, Kash Patel are the big ones who had basically for as long as QAnon has been a movement, have been heavily beating the drum that there are some hidden files, particularly related to the sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein, that will reveal a network of complicity with Trump's enemies and enemies of the MAGA movement in general, be it Democratic politicians, be it Hollywood celebrities. The kind of general list of grievances is pretty long within that movement. And this was a specific promise that Trump actually made on his campaign this time. It was kind of an interesting change from, I think, the Trump administration's initial relationship with QAnon during his first term, where they kind of kept it at a distance. They wouldn't necessarily disavow. Trump administration officials would often say stuff like, if they were asked about it, oh, I haven't heard much about it. I'm not really sure what that's to do with. They would sort of, pretend not to be really familiar with what was going on with the movement. Versus this time round, where the relationship has just been much cozier. And one piece of outreach that Trump made to, it's not only QAnon who are obviously interested in the crimes of Jeffrey Epstein, but it was an olive branch to that movement and the associated network with it, where during the campaign trail, he promised to declassify all of the Epstein files. And again, in QAnon lore, this was related to kind of similar conspiracy theories about Pizzagate and stuff like that. This was going to be a day of reckoning for the Democratic elite establishment. But this, since gaining power, I would say that this relationship has become a lot more fractured. There was a Pam Bondi promised to release the Epstein client list, which again is a kind of document in a micro imagination, which I'm not particularly convinced actually exists. That was, would be a list of Epstein's clients that were kind of for his kind of illegal activities, his activities to do with sex trafficking. And this was, Pam Bondi kind of promised this day of reckoning, essentially, that this would be released. And I think for much of the QAnon movement, this would be the promised storm, the day that all the enemy's crimes would be released, that they would be vindicated, and there would be a kind of general day of reckoning. There was also promises that there would be a full investigation into Jeffrey Epstein's suicide and what happened there. Essentially, in the last week or so, it has kind of lots of these formerly cozy QAnon influencers have essentially had to walk it back. Have had to, there was a memo released which essentially said there is no new information to be released about Jeffrey Epstein. And in fact, lots of the information that they did release was actually information that was already out there already, including stuff that had been released unredacted before and now was released redacted. So you might even say they were releasing less information than there was out there already. And people like Kash Patel had to essentially make a public statement saying, we've reviewed all the data. There is no client list. There is no, and it's pretty clear that Jeffrey Epstein did in fact kill himself, and there's not any secret trail leading back to anybody in particular. It has not been received well. And this is, I would say, not only by QAnon. It's not been received well by the MAGA base in general. In fact, I just watched, just before this, a clip of Charlie Kirk, who is the director of Turning Point USA, which is a conservative, one of the kind of main sort of conservative outlets, and in conversation with Megyn Kelly, former Fox News host, and they were discussing it and saying what a disgrace it was. So I think, even though there is a relationship to QAnon here, I think the Trump administration's decision to elevate QAnon, to elevate people with relationships to QAnon to positions of power in his own administration, has meant that even more than before, which was an argument that me and my colleagues were often making, that QAnon and the Republican Party were increasingly undistinguishable from one another. That is especially true now. And it feels like this has really caused a significant fracture in the base. I would say it's probably, it's probably been the administration's biggest scandal with its own base so far. Now, I should be clear when I'm saying all of this. I'm actually not much of an expert on the Trump administration or QAnon in the United States, but I do love drama. I do love drama between right-wing groups. So I have been watching all of this pretty closely because I think it's something that I'm particularly interested in right now, the kind of new relationships that are being forged between the right and the various factions within it, as well as the fractures that are happening, particularly as a result of social media. So I think I'm watching this closely. I think it's really interesting. I think it's connected to lots of ways that the right is re-evolving. The American right is re-evolving in the second Trump administration, particularly with things like the growing ambivalence over things like Israel and anti-Semitism more broadly as well. I'd say I think that feels very related to this this burning interest in Epstein and the kind of the secrets of the Epstein files.
Annie, when we last spoke in October 2020, that was, I think, precisely the moment that Facebook finally decided they were going to crack down on this QAnon stuff. In 2025, it's hard to imagine them making a similar decision. When I, go and have a look at Facebook, even I would say on like a normie Facebook account, I still get served a fair bit of extremism, anti-Semitism, Holocaust denial, just on Maine. How has social media changed the conspiracy theory landscape?
That's a really great question, and it's one I am also trying to figure out myself. I mean, there's obviously, I think one of the biggest changes in social media moderation since we last spoke is obviously Elon Musk taking over formerly Twitter, now X. I think that has had a really big impact on the state of play with conspiracy theories and the right in general, because, of course, one of his decisions was to reinstate all of these previous extremist right-wing accounts, not just in the US, also, you know, people like in my own country, Tommy Robinson, who's a far-right anti-Muslim agitator. I don't think it's like actually always been... It's obviously one of those things where it's obviously given, yeah, characters like Tommy Robinson, characters like Nick Fuentes, a new reinstated profile. It's made them much more powerful again. I also think it has had a sort of slightly unintended impact of actually radicalizing a lot of more talented figures on the right who were really good, I think, at kind of straying the divide bridging the divide between the far right and the center right in a way that was, I often thought, was pretty clever. So I'm thinking of people like Candace Owens and things like that, people who I think thought were really effective actually at communicating just enough sort of resentment against minorities to keep people activated, to keep them interested, to sound exciting, but could still keep a foot in more mainstream right-wing circles. I think a lot of those have genuinely been radicalized by this unleashing of the previously extreme accounts, be that QAnon or just accounts that were considered too far right to be sort of beyond the pale, so to speak. But I'm really glad you pointed this out about Facebook, because I think so much attention has been paid to Twitter that people are missing, I think, the fact that this is part of a trend. You might say Musk maybe was a pioneer of it, but certainly on Facebook, YouTube is the big place I have noticed. You know, I notice this stuff because on pretty much any social media platform I join as a researcher, my first goal is trying to teach the algorithm. I'm, you know, constantly begging the algorithm, show me the Nazis, show me the conspiracy theorists, you know, show me the most extreme stuff you've got. And that's a negotiation I'm making with the algorithm. So it's always intriguing to see essentially how much the algorithm chooses to indulge me in that request. And certainly with YouTube, I have noticed for a long time, it would give me, you know, again, accounts that were just edgy enough, but not the most edgy stuff they had on there. I recently, just in the last month, had naked Holocaust denial promoted to me, which I haven't had for a good few years. I've also seen some semi-prominent far-right YouTubers bragging about having been unshadow banned. So it seems to me that decisions are being made. They're being made with very little fanfare, certainly compared to when we spoke in 2020 when, yeah, Facebook was under an enormous amount of pressure to ban QAnon-related content, particularly in the wake of January the 6th. And it was really slow compared to other social media. Facebook and Instagram were both really slow. But it did make a huge amount of noise about how it had banned various QAnon accounts. At the time, I think I remember saying this hasn't gone particularly far. You know, they haven't actually said that they'll do much to prevent these accounts from coming back. Lots of them are already networked on other sites, so it won't be hard for them to regain their followings. But but it was better than I think what's happening now, which I think is just a quiet stepping back, essentially, from the duties of moderation in this regard, a kind of slight sort of return to the previous kind of passive state that lots of these social media sites were taking.
Annie, what do you think is the political consequence of allowing, I guess, a kind of permanent far-right ecosystem to develop on social media? What do you think? What does that portend, do you think?
It's really interesting because, I mean, just last year in my country, I feel like we saw some really, in fact, it was exactly around this time last year, maybe it was August, but we saw some real frightening consequences in, internet researchers hate saying in real life to mean not on the internet, because of course the internet is real life in so many regards, but in the offline world where there were a series of riots all over the country, particularly centering around hotels that were known to house asylum seekers. This was pretty effectively traced by researchers to be as a direct consequence of the social media platform X and its totally hands-off approach to misinformation. These riots, I'll give a little potted history, happened in the wake of a really horrific stabbing attack on a dance class of mostly preteen girls. In the wake of that, because the killer was under the age of 18, his name wasn't released immediately. In the wake of that, the far-right media, social media ecosystem fabricated an identity for him, which was of a Muslim asylum seeker. This was later proven to be false. This resulted in the town which it happened, riots emerging outside a local mosque, and then this sparked off further waves of violence around these hotels. In some cases, serious cases, there were actually attempts to burn those hotels down. Local Muslims were dragged out of their cars and attacked by mobs of people. Not only was this misinformation spread around X, not only was there clear inciting posts spread around X, Elon Musk himself actually joined in, started commenting on posts which contained this misinformation, things like civil war is inevitable. It was essentially really frightening to see a real life pogrom essentially happening in the wake of a social media platform essentially just taking its hands off the steering wheel, and in Musk's case, you could say actually probably putting his hand back on the steering wheel and steering it in the direction of this kind of violence. So I think the effects are really, really visible in that regard. But also I think there's also been, because, you know, there was a constant sort of back and forth among internet researchers about how Twitter as a platform, you know, people would say Twitter is not real life. And I think there was often a slight dominance of interest in Twitter because it was where a lot of journalists and researchers hung out themselves versus platforms like Facebook, which were considered a bit declassé by that class. And therefore, I certainly noticed a lot of Facebook conspiracy theories, for instance, got a lot less interest than ones that circulated on Twitter. But I do think there has been a notable radicalization of certainly my country's elite. By this, I mean journalists and politicians, often, I think, echoing, and I've noticed this more actually since I've stopped using X myself, as a personal social media platform. I obviously still use it for research, but I tend not to post anything myself there anymore. But I certainly have noticed that it feels really noticeable when I can tell that a national broadsheet journalist, a politician, uses the place quite heavily because their understanding of what the public sentiment is and what the public conversation is often, I think, noticeably skewed in a very, very far right direction. I'll give an example. So the riots I was talking about last year, only 7% of British people believe those riots were justified. When that 7% of people were asked, do they think the country as a whole supported the riots? 82% of them said yes. I think if you were to try and gain the national mood simply through not even far right, just centre right journalists talking about those riots. They would refer to them as populist. They would say the British public did this. The British public felt they had been ignored. The British public had an outwave of anger. You know, there's really a sense that that was a representative mood, and in fact that our Prime Minister Keir Starmer misjudged things by calling them far right, when in fact it was just an outpouring of national rage. So I think it has, by maybe never having been a particularly representative platform, but being a platform where much of the country's tastemakers, you might say, commentators hang out, I think that has really changed the tenor of a lot of the discussion that I've noticed in my own country.
Annie, speaking of your country, another hot new trend that's emerged since we last spoke to you is transphobia, which appears to have had an effect upon more than perhaps 7% of the population, certainly a number of parliamentarians. Can you maybe explain where the trans phenomenon sits within the far-right imagination and how it's played out in the UK, because it seems to be a fairly successful movement to constrict the rights of those who are transgender?
Absolutely. I'm gonna start this answer with a plug for my enormously talented colleague, Liv Agar. She is actually just working on a mini-series called Science in Transition, which specifically traces the history and origins of the anti-trans backlash. That's for the podcast network that my podcast QAA runs, Cursed Media. So for the long answer to this, please, please go check that out. She's an expert. I'm not. And I've listened to the first two episodes. It's really thoughtful, nuanced stuff. But I do think that in my country, this relationship between transphobia, the far right, and feminism has a particularly British history, actually, which I think relates to a few different things. So one thing that people don't actually often know about this country and its history is that the British fascist movement of the 1920s and 30s, you know, at the time when fascism was the real hot new ideology sweeping Europe, Oswald Mosley, who was the leader of the British Union of Fascists, was feminist, but he was a huge, huge admirer and fan of the suffragettes, which was really different to Italian fascism and German fascism, which held to a much more traditionalist gender ideology. The way that we would typically think of fascist thinking of gender, you know, women, Kinderkirche, Hücke. And so when Oswald Mosley was a huge admirer of the suffragettes. He loved the kind of flashy way that they had gone ahead with direct action. He actually just really liked the archetype of a female warrior, and he specifically wooed many former suffragettes. He wanted them to be many of whom were sort of minor celebrities of their day. He wanted them to be part of his party. And some were seduced. I mean, sometimes people can get a bit simplistic about this. Some were seduced, some weren't. Some became communists. It's a rich and varied movement. But I think that is a really interesting relationship. And it is often, I think, ignored that essentially for a very long time, the far right and popular feminist movement, which is a broad term, have not always necessarily been opposing one another, essentially. I think that makes a really different character of British feminist, and I think the relative lack of power of the religious right in this country, you know, we didn't have things like the kind of, in the United States, they had, you know, this kind of merging of the religious right of Catholic and the evangelical church to oppose things like contraception and abortion. So the feminist movement, although it's not as if it had an easy time, civil rights movements never do, it didn't find itself defining itself against the religious right. And I think that has changed the character of British feminism. in a sense, which means that when we get to the current day and the anti-trans backlash, there has been a really interesting convergence of what you might call, which I think I'll call sort of, you know, elite feminist rhetoric about the dangers of transgender ideology, quotation marks around that, and the resurgence of a far-right panic around gender divergence, and in particular the spectre of the kind of transgender predator. I think, again, you don't really get the kind of merging of these two ideologies until you get their kind of confluence on social media. But it is really fascinating, I think, the way that the anti-trans feminist movement has radicalized, even in just the last 10 years that I have been, I guess, I don't know if I would say monitoring that community because it's not my field of study, but since I've been aware of it, I think it has become very much single issue in this regard. I feel like 10 years ago, I was seeing feminists who were broadly anti-trans also talk about other feminist issues. They would talk about things like sex work. They would talk about domestic violence, sexual harassment, catcalling, what have you. It feels to me, abortion, it feels to me that increasingly the leading lights of the anti-trans feminist movement have no interest in those issues at all. In fact, when there was a recent piece of legislation passed in Parliament to decriminalise abortion past the abortion limit of 24 weeks. So this didn't legalise it, I should be clear. It decriminalised it, essentially prevented women from being prosecuted for having an abortion past that limit. I was just curious, actually, to see how the anti-trans feminist movement had responded to it. And I found, bar one exception, who was Julie Bindle, who does actually have more of a history of feminist activism than a lot of the lights of the anti-trans feminist movement, for which this seems to be their first and only kind of activist interest. Most were totally silent about it. Some actually opposed it and came out and used what we might think of as just more traditional right-wing language, this legalizes killing babies, etc. Yeah, and I thought that was fascinating because I thought that was a clear-cut example, essentially, of how this movement had polarized itself, not just against their enemies, which they view more broadly as the kind of progressive movement in general, who is firmly pro-trans, but also, I think, polarized as a result of rubbing shoulders for a long time with the far right on social media. That had affected their, not only the language that they were using, which is, you know, really noticeable, but actually the content of what they were saying as well on issues that aren't to do with LGBT.
And that also seems to apply in the case of at least a number of fairly prominent transphobes with regards to criticisms of the threats posed by migrant workers, which I think ties back into the discussion you were having earlier about the riots that took place about a year ago.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And yeah, there's a new, I don't even know what you would call them, a new organisation in my country, which has just cropped up, which call themselves, it's a new organisation called the Women's Safety Initiative, which, popped up on the British news channels, on social media in the last few months, which are all using a feminist rhetoric about women's vulnerability to violence, about protecting women, but it is entirely directed at migrant crime. And specifically, I think the chief spokesperson, Jess Gill, gave a really revealing comment in one clip that I watched, where I think she said, I forget the exact statistic. Maybe she said one in five crimes of sexual violence are committed by a non-British national. I've no idea if that statistic is correct or not, but that's the figure she gave. And then she said that's one in five cases of sexual violence which didn't need to happen. And I find that a really interesting framing because of how it relates, I think, to a certain strand of feminist pessimism, you might say. It often uses second wave rhetoric, but, you know, the thing about the second wave, which often gets forgotten, is these radical feminist theorists were creating entirely new imaginaries. You know, they were called radical for a reason. They often were reading back on, you know, their full thing. They're often deeply optimistic in the possibilities that they thought could be created for new gender settlements, you might say. Even people like Andrea Dworkin, who have been slightly totemized by, reactionary feminists today, were often creating, you might even say, entirely sort of sci-fi future imaginaries for what was possible between men and women. This is a much more narrow, I think, conception of what is possible. They're essentially saying that male violence against women is inevitable. It cannot be changed. And all really that can be changed is we can tinker with who does it to us, with who, you know, who is permitted to commit violence against us. And this initiative, I think, you know, following on from the success of anti-trans feminism in this country, is essentially saying the horror is essentially not the act of sexual violence itself, but the idea that a foreigner, that an outsider is doing it to you. And there's something more comfortable with being, you know, even though you may object, even though it's unpleasant, there's something more comfortable with violence being committed to against you by, you might say, in this case, someone of your own nationality. But I think it connects with things like the rise of the tradwife phenomenon, who will kind of make it even go one step further and say, at least, you know, if violence will be committed against you, at least it should be by someone who's married to you. It should be by your husband rather than by a more unknowable and less stable or permanent relationship.
Not very cheery stuff.
Yeah, sorry. It's not a cheery topic.
No, I don't have a cheery one to transition to. I was going to ask, Annie, earlier we talked about, the FBI conspiracy, the conspiracy theorists who've made it to the upper echelons of the FBI.
Mm.
Another example of the dog that caught the car might be RFK Jr., who's now the Secretary of Health. I was wondering if you could speak to what the impact has been of having an anti-vaxxer in charge of health policy in one of the largest nations on the planet.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously the result has been catastrophic. But I don't think we can just blame RFK Jr. as much as tempting as it is, given his huge position of power. The reason I say this is because I think that there has been a complacency around a surge in anti-vaccine sentiment overall. And actually, just in this country, we recently had a death of a child at a vaccine, a death of a child from measles in Liverpool in this country. We can't blame RFK Jr. for that, but a statistic that I found out from it was that in that city, only 75% of children have received the MMR vaccine. And supposedly for herd immunity to work, it needs to be 95%. Since the COVID pandemic, there has been, doctors have reported, a huge drop-off in childhood vaccinations happening in this country. And I think that is a global trend. So I remember at the time being concerned with the way that discussion happened around the COVID vaccine and anti-vaccine sentiment, for a while as someone who had been to anti-vaccine rallies, who had talked to people there. While the vaccine rollout was still happening, people were really, there was a great deal of interest in the mainstream press. There was a great deal of anxiety. Lots of people were, you know, curious about what these people were saying, where they were coming from, and you know, trying to understand, I think, making honest attempts to understand. It felt that after the vaccine was rolled out, sufficient people took it, that it meant that COVID pandemic measures could loosen. It felt like there was a real downturn in interest. People said, oh, you know, thank goodness that's all over now. Enough people took it. It was nothing to worry about after all. But I think there was a genuine loss of trust in public health, and particularly in vaccines. Lots of people had become radicalized, not just against the COVID vaccine, but against vaccines in general. You know, they were at first looking up information on whether they should get the COVID vaccine, but then they were finding themselves in communities where people were saying, well, have you heard what the MMR does to children? Have you heard what this vaccine does to children? In general, you know, vaccines are full of poison. They're full of these toxins. You know, you can be vaccine injured. And I think there was just a really terrifying kind of upswing of, if not total anti-vax sentiment, then a general, I think, ambivalence. I think that's probably a better word. You know, these people, a lot of them aren't saying, absolutely not, I'm never taking my child to get vaccinated. They're sort of saying, well, is it worth the risk? They're still so young. You know, maybe I'll take them for it when they're a little bit stronger. I just couldn't do it to them right now. What's the harm in waiting for a little while? And I think that vaccine hesitancy, vaccine ambivalence, particularly in parents, has had real consequences. And I think the rising star of someone like RFK Jr. was directly related to his ability to speak for those people. You know, he cast an incredibly empathetic voice to that sphere of people. And so, yeah, the consequences in the States, I think, and actually beyond, because, of course, this is related to things like the cutting of just total demolition of US aid. The US was, in many countries, the main supplier of so many life-saving vaccines. And I think, you know, amid all the horrors that are being beamed to us from places like Gaza, I think that there are just untold amount of deaths of children directly related to that political decision as well. So I guess what I'm saying is that it's disastrous, RFK Jr. being given the position of power that he has been given. But I think he's a symptom as well as a cause in this regard.
Annie, obviously the world needs good information, not bad. Do you think that instrumentalities like Grok might be aiding us in our attempt to expand the horizons of human knowledge or not?
Well, in a weird way, I am actually a little bit grateful for how clumsily Grok conveys information, as opposed to, you might say, the slightly more smooth relation of LLMs like ChatGPT, because we can all see Grok getting tinkered with and, you know, Musk says, I'm going to make it more anti-woke. And next thing you know, Grok is spewing out just plain, well, I was going to say Holocaust denial, but it's actually one step more. It's a straight up endorsement of the Holocaust and things of that nature. I actually hope it will maybe help us to demystify what's happening with LLMs at the minute. At the minute, it feels like a lot of people are using LLMs as a strange kind of secular oracle, in a sense. And there are actually really interesting cases which have been covered by the podcast I work for of people who seemingly actually give themselves some form of religious psychosis through using ChatGPT and LLMs like this way, because I think the human mind actually just really struggles with having a conversation with an unknown, an unseen entity, and not conceiving of it as a form of intelligence in some way. We just seem quite bad at being able to understand that this is essentially a predictive text program. It doesn't have any kind of higher wisdom that you are accessing. So I'm sure I've heard that, you know, every time new technologies have rolled out, there have been these kind of strange things happening to the human mind as we've grappled with it. I follow a journalist called James Vincent who pointed out that apparently on the advent of the telephone, people were saying things that they could hear the voices of the dead through the telephone. So it seems like this is something that just generally happens with every new industrial innovation, that we struggle to comprehend it, we struggle to integrate it into our worldview, and eventually we do. I actually hope that we can see more obvious examples of large language models being tinkered with, being tampered with, going essentially a little bit hinky in some regard, so that people can better comprehend what it is they're actually using, what the technology that they're using does, you know, on a practical level, and then being able to use it usefully.
Well, as the Australia's anti-Semitism envoy pointed out the other day, Elon Musk and XAI are doing a lot to root out hate using AI on their platform. I mean,
no, you have, really?
You oh have my to say, gosh. He did turn off the Mecha Hitler bot. So that's like,
that is, yeah. He's both creating the anti-Semitism and then turning it off. Yeah.
Annie, we'll have to leave it there. If people want to hear more of your work, you are, of course, on the QAnon Anonymous podcast, and people should check out cursedmedia.net, where you can check out a whole bunch of related material, including your Man Clan series, which is very much worth a listen.
Yes, please do check it out. And we will be producing more content, which I'm not allowed to talk about just yet, but there's more coming. So stay tuned.
Excellent. And of course, you're on Blue Sky. Annie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Andy, that is our program. We will catch you next week.
See you then.
Kafirs are Palestinian scarves, and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people. From the traditional black and white kafir to an array of modern designs, explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. Wear your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to kufiyas.org.au. That's kufiyas.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are, at home, work, driving,
on public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.